ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Get a dog, they said. It will be life-affirming, they said. And yes, all that unconditional love and enthusiasm for walks is wonderful, but being a pet parent is complicated. They wreck your furniture, terrify your nieces and nephews, are intent on eating things that will send you on an expensive trip to the vet. Sometimes it's your expectations of yourself that you're letting down. Dealing with pet regret in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, tributes are flowing this morning for renowned pathologist and melanoma researcher, Professor Richard Scolyer. Professor Scolyer died yesterday at the age of 59 after a nearly three-year battle with an aggressive form of brain cancer. Inspiring to the end, we'll reflect on Richard's life and legacy later in the show, but I wanted to share a part of a speech he recorded and shared with the next generation of health and medicine students.
In 2023, my life changed. I was diagnosed with glioblastoma. Becoming a patient changes everything. Because of my research background, I asked a different question. What if we try something new? The questions you ask and the courage you show can change lives. Be brave, be bold, and challenge the status quo. With you all, the future is in good hands.
Richard's life and legacy touched so many. In about 40 minutes' time, I'll speak to Gary Maddox. He's a senior writer at Sydney Morning Herald, and he helped Richard Scolyer write his biography, Brainstorm. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, parenting famously doesn't come with a handbook. Sure, there's an endless stream of information out there about how to prepare your kids for the big bad world without messing them up too much. But navigating all of this conflicting advice can be overwhelming and, frankly, sometimes unhelpful. How do you know if you're doing what's best for them? Well, today you're going to hear from someone who knows what they're talking about. He's a developmental pediatrician with over 20 years' experience working with children and families, helping them through some of their hardest moments. Dr. Billy Garvey. He's already a best-selling author. He's about to release his second book, 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Raising Boys. Dr. Billy Garvey, host of Pop Culture Parenting and, of course, a father of three. Welcome back to Life Matters.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's amazing to be back.
It's so good to hear your voice. So, Billy, this is your second book. Your first one was all about the things you wish parents knew about their kids' mental health. Why did you want to come back specifically talking about raising boys?
Yeah, I think a big part of it is just what I'm seeing in clinic with a lot of the boys that I meet, you know, from the early years and then the boys that are entering adult life, but also just what I'm seeing in the broader community and just how much it worries me. And there's a lot of kind of, for want of a better word, snake oil out there about what to do about these things. And so I'm just trying to put the science out there in a way that people can actually understand it and guide the boys they care about.
There definitely is a lot of hand-wringing about boys at the moment. What are you sort of hoping you can do to cut through here?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is kind of my own story, the story of raising a son, the worries that I have for my two daughters in the world as it currently is, and then really at the core of it, it's the story of, you know, a handful of boys and just how much I've learned off them over the last 26 years working with kids and how we can actually use their stories to guide us so that our boys have an easier time than they did and we can spot earlier that a boy needs help, we can understand what we can actually do about it. And so, yeah, we've stepped through some, like, really heavy topics that we're kind of, I hope, land well that people can actually use, because I think there's so much, like guilt and shame around this that a lot of people then just understandably turn away from it. But what I'm hoping is that we can validate how difficult this is for us, especially if our own childhood comes into it a lot, but find a path through it.
When you talk about guilt and shame, what are people carrying?
I think so many people I meet in clinic think that, you know, because they did something in the younger years or didn't do something or were stressed or had a certain approach that they've now doomed their child or their relationship with their child, and I've never seen that to be true. And I think that as we learn about this, like this generation of parents is just getting so much information thrown at them, and then a lot of them are thinking, well, I didn't do that when he was a baby, or gosh, I was also saying that, or I was ignoring him, or I was saying, you know, just toughen up or you're fine. I didn't really understand what resilience was, those type of things. But the beautiful thing about growing minds is that they can, you know, they have so much flexibility in them that you can come back and say, we're going to work on this together, I'm going to help you, and we're going to change this. And, you know, facing that challenge that's in front of the boy with them is what is most of what I do in clinic with these kids. Mm. I just sit there and try and understand their perspective and then journey with them. And clinical stuff comes up and diagnoses and all that stuff. But really what most of my work is what's the underlying need and how do we get that met for this child?
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Dr. Billy Garvey. He's a developmental pediatrician, author, host of the Pop Culture Parenting Podcast, and a father of three. His second book is about to be released. It's called 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Raising Boys. So let's talk about raising boys this morning. I'd love to know your experience or your questions. If you've got a question you want to put to a Dr. Billy Garvey, or if you have some hard-earned wisdom you want to share. Juliet says, as a single mum of two boys, when they were teenagers, the best thing was that they had part-time jobs after school and on the weekend. They had a different reality check from bosses who told them they needed to iron their shirts before they went to work, etc. Having a different framework from someone other than me was most helpful. And Greg says, my biggest mistake raising a son was listening to other soccer parents. They said, oh, it's just boys, when I asked if my son's easy distraction and other ADHD signs were becoming apparent. Should have got onto it much earlier, but he wasn't diagnosed with ADHD until he was a young adult. Billy, I'm interested in that line, oh, it's just boys. It's something that you hear a fair bit. What's your reaction to that phrase?
I think it's a really harmful phrase, boys will be boys. I think that it creates a real ceiling of the potential for boys, especially in their emotional and social developments. And it also like excuses a lot of behaviour that we should actually be recognised as a worrying sign about their development and their beliefs. So I really worry about that idea that like boys are behave a certain way and we should expect less of them.
Are boys wired differently to girls, or do we just parent them differently?
We definitely, you know, it's kind of the boring answer to the nurture versus nature debate is that there is two components to it. We do know that in terms of their neurological development, that they are often delayed in their development of impulse control, for example, and how reactive they can be. There's often a language problem as well, that they will often be behind in their language development in those early years. But it's a really good example of where the environment is different for them too. We know boys hear less words. They're faced to a caregiver less, you know, they are spoken to less, they are sung to less. We also know that the way that we speak to boys is different to girls as well. We're more likely to be punitive and, you know, call them out for behaviour as opposed to a girl where we connect with them and guide them through and try and understand their experience. And even before boys are born, we speak about them differently. He's tough, he's strong. Mm. You know, he's going to be a heartbreaker, and the boy's not even in the world yet. And so the girl is kind and caring and gentle. And, you know, so she comes into the world with that path laid out ahead of her. And then think about all of her play-based activities, you know, caring for dolls and sitting and enjoying playtime with someone at a tea party. And the boy, you know, we feel a little bit uncomfortable about a little boy doing that, but he's missing out on this rich opportunity. And that's where, you know, there's a big influence in those very early years about how we parent boys differently.
I mean, we're talking about it so much more than we used to be. You've been in this space for a long time now. Like, are we making progress? Are we changing these narratives?
I think we are in some ways because parents are trying to learn. Like parents, you know, I'm lucky I work in this space, and I just am always so impressed by parents that are putting in this hard work to learn how they can better support their child's development because of the impact it has on their future. What's worrying is that the rates of mental illness are increasing, the rates of domestic violence are not getting any better, you know, the rates of suicide are something that's really horrifying. It's the leading cause of death for boys 15 to 49 years of age. And we know that they're three times more likely to die by suicide. So there is something that we need to do that we're not doing enough of at the moment. And so much of it, in my experience and what the evidence shows, is about building the emotional and social capacity of our boys. So I really take my hat off to all the parents that are trying really hard. But I also think there's so much noise in this space, whether it's like, you know, unhealthy masculine influences. There's also people that are seeing really big business opportunities about building out programs and things like that that have no scientific or research or clinical evidence behind them. So it's become a really noisy space. And that's what we try and do with our work, is we work with not-profits and academic organizations, but also we go into the spaces where people actually live their lives, whether footy clubs or schools, and build the capacity of those people that have hard-earned relationships with these boys. So I'm still worried, but I'm hopeful, because I'm really privileged in the fact that I've seen some of the most worrying boys turn with when we actually understand what's going on for them and what we can do about it.
Can we talk practical points here? If I'm a parent or of someone who has a young boy in my life and I want to be there for them, what do I do to build that emotional capacity you're talking about?
Yes, I mean, really one important thing is understand their experience, you know, and try and observe them, try and be with them, you know, make sure you play with them and you're part of their world. I meet lots of mums that are like, I know that's what dad does. And it's, you know, there's a real risk in that, oh, dad's the one that goes and kicks the footy. Dad's the one that does that thing with them. I do everything else. I make all the meals and I, you know, sort out everything else in their life. But often those points of connection happen when we're just having fun and boys feel really relaxed and they feel safe and just trying to explore what their experience is. Because we know a lot of boys just won't speak to anyone. There's a real unhealthy belief that actually gets policed by other boys and men that you shouldn't speak to people about your feelings and what you're worried about. And so the relationship is a really important thing that often starts just in small, frequent, predictable and safe environments and relationships where play is the focus and it's just about enjoying this kid. Then we also know how important role modeling emotional difficulties is. Like, a lot of boys and men think it's just bury it, suppress it. That's what real men do, you know, boys don't cry. And so what that lays out is a pathway that's very narrow for boys, where the only thing I can be is angry. You know, the only way I can deal with difficult emotions is through aggression. And if I have any insecurity, fear of rejection, fear, I'm less of a man, you know. And we need to really challenge that actively, because we know all of those beliefs increase substance use, they increase intimate partner violence, and they increase mental illness in our boys and men.
I'm chatting with Dr. Billy Garvey. He's a developmental paediatrician at one of Australia's largest paediatric hospitals. He's the host of the Pop Culture Parenting podcast, the author of a new book, 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Raising Boys. Guess what we're talking about today? Raising boys. There's a question here from Kate, Billy. Kate says, I have a 16-year-old son. He's decent. He's got good mental health. But how fragile are they really? I always worry when I push him with study to get to where he wants to be in 5 years. I can tell he has no perspective of time and is more interested in friends and gaming. I want him to have a good time when he's young, but I want to be a good parent and I don't want him to look back and wish I had done better, even if it's hard. We have to keep this advice general, but I think that sentiment is very relatable, Billy.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the hard thing, is we look back and go, gosh, you know, I wish that I'd realized like how important school was or something like that. But the risk is that pressure often doesn't really help us, especially if it's like completely extrinsically motivated, that the kid has no understanding why they would put effort into that thing. And so with a lot of the teenage boys that I meet, the connection piece comes first. And I actually use video games a lot to connect with these boys. It's something that was a big part of my childhood. It's something that I still have a part of my adult life. And one of the big reasons is because it's such a connection piece. And I meet a lot of boys that won't leave their bedroom at all. They haven't attended school for years. And all they're doing is like watching YouTubers or playing video games. And that's my starting point. And I often say to the parents, learn about that world and go into it, and then you'll help them come out of that room. And it's a really important fact about, instead of just being like, you need to stop doing that, you're destroying your future, trying to find the connection piece first.
It's interesting that you mentioned that as a general trend. Steve says, I have a son with ADHD and dyslexia. He's about to turn 14. His cohort seems to be really struggling with school attendance and a general lack of enthusiasm for learning. Are you seeing this across the board for this cohort, or is this just a general puberty with boys thing?
Yeah, it's a bit like the boys will be boys thing. It's like, you know, teenage boys, it's not normal to shut down. It's not, you know, it's something we worry about when we see that they are not attending school successfully. And that's not because something's wrong with the child. It's often that the system just doesn't know how to support them. And we're still seeing a lot of kids you know, the homeschooling community, for example, is really growing and expanding because they are much more flexible and they are really relationship based often in these communities. And schools are just struggling under a strain of a lack of resources. Educators aren't paid enough. They're not supported enough. They're leaving the profession in really high rates as well, because the main concern that's happening is what's happening in the community more broadly around our mental health. And so that's impacting our boys because of what's going on in households, around income, around the relationships of community support and how hard it is to access specialist care. And so when you also have the burden of like trying to understand how to support a child who has ADHD and dyslexia, then there's a real risk that is a negative experience for that boy in regards to his self-esteem. And that's one thing that, you know, the idea of resilience and self-esteem is really poorly understood around how do we actually understand the skills that this child needs to go into that environment, have a sense of belonging and success, and also feel safe that they're not going to fail, especially in those teenage years where their peer relationships and their identity is something they're exploring, but it has risk because they feel inadequate or that they're not good enough to be a part of it.
What do we misunderstand about resilience and self-esteem?
I think the biggest thing I think about resilience is that this idea of like, oh, just adversity will harden you up, or that, you know, you should just toughen up and this will make you stronger. And the reality is like, and sometimes we say this in clips on social media, and it's always men that are like, you're completely wrong, and they'll come really hyper aggressively. And it's like, well, you're just showing how your coping mechanism is one that's not healthy, where complete strangers, you're attacking them and being derogatory and calling them names and swearing at them. That's not a like well-balanced individual that's like, I'm really resilient. Resilience is the idea that you build the skills to go through adversity and to be able to evaluate it and make sense of it in a healthy way. And a lot of us have had childhood experiences like adversity in childhood is the biggest predictor of mental illness in adult life. And we know that household dysfunction, abuse, neglect is something that's really prevalent in our communities. And so the idea that these experiences in childhood make you more resilient is completely wrong. It does the opposite. It makes you hypersensitive. It makes you not trust people. It makes you insecure in your own self-esteem and your relationships. It teaches you often unhealthy forms of managing difficult feelings such as aggression and violence. And so the idea is that resilience is actually about trying to build the skill set. And a lot of it is things like help seeking. It's around emotional regulation. It's around conflict resolution. It's around healthy assertiveness. But every single child has a different need in that. So a routine approach that comes and says, we're all going to do the same thing and it'll make you resilient, or, you know, I'll just throw you in the deep end, you'll learn how to swim and you'll be great for it. But that's not how we teach kids how to swim. It's not how we teach kids how to ride a bike. So I really don't understand how we expect our boys to become more resilient because we let them figure it out on their own.
So you've written this book as a guide to help parents raise young boys. What are the fundamentals?
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit about already, like how early it starts, even before they're born, those early years, and how important it is that we talk to them and sing to them and hold them and face them. But then we understand, you know, we go through and see like anger and aggression and understand that those really predictable experiences that boys have, but we have to give them healthier outlets for anger than aggression. We talk a lot about discipline in the book, about the risk of punishments and how that can send kids the wrong way. There's some really helpful stuff, hopefully, around friendship development. A lot of boys will have quite superficial friends in a lot of them, but the research shows us that, like, it's not the number of friends, it's the depth and the quality of the friendship. So we talk about how we support and scaffold support around boys to develop those deeper friendships. We talk about resilience. There's some, you know, really important topics that we cover around sex and intimacy and affection and pornography. We know that the age of exposure to those that material is getting younger, and the influence it can have on boys if we don't role model healthy boundaries and consent and teach them those skills and give them that understanding. And then there's a big piece around healthy masculinity and how we push back against the real toxic beliefs about boys shouldn't cry, boys shouldn't ask for help, you know, all of the stuff that we know, that they shouldn't be caregivers, they shouldn't have a role in the home of, you know, cleaning and making food and all that stuff. And it just cycles through. But it does end on a word of hope and these stories about the boys that I've met that have faced this stuff initially on their own or with people that weren't sure how to support them, and then how they found the path through when we understand that connection piece and what the practical steps are to support all those different areas of their development.
You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Dr. Billy Garvey. He's a developmental pediatrician. His new book is called 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Raising Boys. And I'm taking your questions and wisdom on raising boys today. Linda says, one of my most important things I taught my boys was to do housework. They're adults now and very good at doing work around the home. Another says, growing teenage boys during a pandemic, there's no textbook. Some are angry for missing out on the norms. Others got through it fine. They had no expectations. Hope we never go through this again. And a third, really a question, Billy. This person says, I find it tricky as a grandparent to make suggestions to parents of grandsons when the children show me signs they aren't coping. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, the grandparent piece is a really interesting one because we hear about this in clinic a lot. And I think the important thing, you know, the best thing that grandparents can do is ask, how can I help, and validate and connect with the experience of the parents and thinking about, you know, how can I step in? And those grandparents often had a different parent experience to what's happening in the world today. And so I think, you know, really trying to connect with the parent first and then try and understand how can I practically provide some support. What a lot of parents need is they just need less demands on them and more support. And so thinking about how can I take things off this, that's what a lot of us need. Like, I don't have any family around to support my kids, but often it's just the how difficult mealtimes are, how difficult it is getting kids in the car and that stuff. And so, you know, I think starting with that practical piece, and then if the parent opens up and says, hey, look, I'm finding this tough, or opening up questions about how do you think, like, Tegan's going, and saying, oh, okay, and go, well, look, she actually looks like she's pretty anxious and I'm really worried that that's going on. What do you think? I think a lot of the time we become quite hostile to people that come in and say, you're not parenting well, or that's how we hear it. Mm. And so trying to make sure that we validate that and do it in a really safe, gentle way is the best pathway, because we often, you know, the other flip side of that is we have a lot of parents that either in clinic or in our broader community through pop culture parenting will say, can you just tell parents to give me a break? They're telling me that, like, back when I was a kid, I would have never spoken like that. I would have never yelled. I would have never, like, behaved that way. And it can induce shame, but it's also, like, the reality is that a lot of us will reflect back and romanticize the parenting journey we had, because it's really difficult to say, yeah, well, probably it was because you were afraid of me, that was why you were compliant, not because I actually created a safe environment for you to express your emotions.
So this book is really personal to you, Billy. You talk about how it's a dedication to your son. You actually have posted about this. I might actually play a little bit of video if you don't mind.
Too many boys and men are poor in love and alone in their anger. I often find myself needing hope these days. There's so much sadness and pain in the world. Boys and men are harming themselves and others. I want to shield you from this and allow you to remain the tender and gentle boy who can hold love and anger as safe and healthy experiences that help you grow. Too many boys and men are poor in love and alone in their anger. I want the world to learn that by holding you, guiding you, protecting you and loving you, we can create a place that is truly safe, healthy and happy.
Billy, can you explain what you were feeling when you were penning that letter to your son, Charlie?
Oh, yeah. God, I get emotional just hearing it, because I was writing it on the plane. I was writing it on a plane, like, in the middle seat between two other people, two guys actually, and just, like, crying writing it, because the publishers had asked me and said, would you consider this? And so I just tried to write it to him. It's also, like, it's to me as a little boy as well, you know, and just the experience that I grew up in. And I think, like, sometimes people will say, oh, it's so generous of you to share all this knowledge, but it's not really. It's, I'm actually trying to heal myself and try and, like, I spend a lot of time in clinic looking for little Billy, you know, and just trying to change his path. And that's what I'm trying to do for my son as well. Like, he's this tender, beautiful, sensitive boy. And I just worry that what's the world going to do for him? Like, is it going to turn him away from that and say, that's not tough, you know, that's not being a man, you need to be strong, you need to bury your emotions, you know, stand over people, be hostile, because that's the world I grew up in. And so, yeah, it's funny, I read it out at our live show that's touring, and I'm just so emotional every single time. And it's this really beautiful experience, because we have hundreds of people that hold that space with me. And it's a really amazing thing that if you see on the social media, like, you can kind of feel it a little bit. There's, like, 600-700 people that are just holding space with me in that clip. And I think that's what we all need to do for each other a bit more. It's just, how do we actually hold space? How do we understand how to do that? And it's a really important thing for our boys because they're just often so alone. And we just know that that experience happens quite young for them. And so that's kind of what I was thinking about myself when I was a little boy, my son is a little boy. A lot of the angry, you know, violent 18, 19-year-olds that I meet that are committing crimes and stuff, they're lonely, scared little boys, you know. And when you understand that and connect with them, you can actually find the path through. And it's not about punishing them or decreasing the age they go into jail. It's about, you know, you're lost and I want to stand next to you and help you find the way through. And that's, it's also the selfish thing to do as well, because we know that incarcerating these kids just has an 85% rate of reoffending in 12 months. It doesn't make our community safer. We have to understand that when we connect with these boys and support them and understand and heal them from what's happened to them, that they have the same potential as the rest of us. You know, I was told my whole life I wouldn't amount to anything, and I probably will never recover from that. So it's just a really important thing that we understand what's really going on for our boys, because it's harming them, but also all of us too.
Well, Billy, thank you so much for sharing. Congrats on the book. Dr. Billy Garvey is a developmental pediatrician, the host of the Pop Culture Parenting podcast, and author of a new book, 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Raising Boys. And I should say, Billy has been a pretty regular guest on Life Matters, especially on Fridays with Beverly Wang. If you would like to hear more of him, just search for Billy Garvey and Life Matters in ABC Listen, and you'll get a lot of practical advice on how to tackle some of those difficult parenting moments. But stick around here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National a bit longer. Coming up next, when your pet is testing the limits of your love.
Saturday Extra with Nick Bryant.
In 1776, the American colonies declared their independence from Britain, and July the 4th is the country's birthday. So join me, Nick Bryant, for our America at 250 series. Conversations on how the past continues to animate the present, with historians and thinkers such as the legendary documentary maker Ken Burns. Saturday Extra, after the 7 a.m. news on Radio National, and anytime on ABC Listen.
Your dog is supposed to be your best friend. And like any relationship, some days are easier than others. People fall out with friends, relationships become strained, sometimes people simply drift apart, but we don't tend to talk about pets that way. There's a particular kind of guilt that comes with struggling to bond with an animal or feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility of caring for one, because unlike other relationships, pet ownership is supposed to be unconditional. So what happens when the connection isn't instant or when you're at your limit? How do you navigate the shame that can come with admitting that it's harder than you expected? Bruce Cherry is a writer and bush regenerator who is here to talk about your dog Steady, Bruce. Tell me about Steady.
Good morning, Tegan. So Steady is 4.5 now, and I got him when he was a few months old. And he's a Kelpie cross cattle dog, which, if you know anything about working dogs, means that he's a pretty busy boy. I did not know enough about working dogs before taking him on. And that probably contributed to our rocky start. But he is very smart. He's very eager to please. So I certainly have not had, you know, some of the challenges that,
Bruce, I think we lost you there for a second, but you're back. Keep on going. Tell us more about Steady.
Sorry, yeah. He's a very easy to train dog. So I've been very lucky in that regard. But yeah, certainly early on, I found it very overwhelming to sudden responsibility all of the time with an animal who he will happily just keep going until nobody will play with him anymore. He doesn't really have an off switch.
As the guardian of a four-year-old, a Kelpie cross myself, I can definitely relate to the Energizer bunny in the house. You were actually a little bit worried before you got your dog. What were you worried about?
Well, I growing up, you know, I was gay and I kind of thought, oh, look, I probably won't have kids. And then as I got to know myself a bit better, then I was like, I don't think I am cut out for the responsibilities of parenthood. It all looks like a lot of hard work. And you know, just knowing myself that I can be quite short-tempered, that I like a lot of my time to myself, there were a number of factors that I was like, oh, I don't know whether this will be a good fit. But I was kind of lulled into an idea of what dog ownership involved by being around quite a few older dogs belonging to other people. And an older dog is a very different kettle of fish to a young puppy.
So you had a bit of a jarring kind of expectation versus reality. How did that play out for you?
Look, it felt pretty dark at the time, and I think that was shocking too, because it's not really something that I had heard other people talk about or reflect on at all in terms of their experience of having a dog. Like part of my motivation around getting a pet was that I knew that it came with mental health benefits. So I was excited about that. And to my dismay, the immediate effect was kind of the opposite. I really did. My anxiety spiked massively because I was so concerned about anything that might happen to him, but also I think very, very aware of, you know, not wanting him to impact others in any negative way. So, you know, not jumping up, not barking in a time where he shouldn't be barking or whatever, all of the little things that can come up. But yeah, I was literally, yeah, crying myself to sleep a couple of nights early on because I just felt so overwhelmed.
Did it get better?
Much. And I mean, it was a process. I probably had Steady for about 6 months before I had sole care of him. I was living with my partner, and so we were both looking after him. And then my partner went away for a couple of months. And so that meant, you know, it was just Steady and I then. And that, while it came with its own challenges, was actually really good for us because it just kind of cemented what we had been laying down in terms of our bond. I feel like it's been a process even since then. Like I feel, you know, much more closely attuned to him now than I did, you know, a couple of years ago. We communicate pretty easily with each other these days. So, yeah, that has certainly shifted. I don't find that his behaviour tends to spike my anxiety at all anymore. And I never go to bed crying myself to sleep over it these days. So
that's a relief.
That's a nice change.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting with Bruce Cherry, a writer and the owner of Steady, who's a good boy most of the time. Also here with us is Dr. Vanessa Rolfe, a clinical counsellor specialising in human-animal interaction. Vanessa, listening to Bruce's story, what stands out to you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It was just really lovely to hear Bruce's story. Actually, what struck me when I read the article and when I'm listening to Bruce now is just its honesty. And I actually suspect that there's probably a lot of people that are listening right now or who have read the article that think, thank goodness someone is actually talking about this out loud. We actually do hear a lot of stories about the joys of pet ownership, but we don't always talk about the adjustment, responsibility, the self-doubt, the worry that can often come from caring for another living being. You know, I certainly don't want to make assumptions about Bruce's experience, but I do think many people will recognise parts of themselves in his story. And for some people, the bond just isn't immediate, and for others, it develops gradually over time, just like Bruce was talking about. One thing I often do think about is that love and anxiety aren't necessarily opposites. Mm. So once we care deeply for someone, whether that's a child, a partner, a friend or animal, we suddenly have something to lose, and that vulnerability can sometimes show up as worry.
People are sharing their stories. One says, I'm a single woman in her 40s. I got my cat for companionship. She is beautiful and I love having her, but I've found many aspects very hard on my own. Little things like cutting her nails, wrangling her into the carrier for vet visits, finding her care when I go away, make me feel more on my own than I was. I love her, but it hasn't been how I imagined. Another says, we got our high energy, high anxiety poodle at 18 months, not recognizing his unstable start to life. He was extremely hard to be with in the first few weeks. He couldn't walk on a lead or travel in a car. The best advice we got from a dog trainer was to respect the dog and see the world from his perspective. Vanessa, this sort of mismatch between expectation and reality, what's the most common misconception people have about being a pet owner?
Yeah, probably the most common misconception that people have is that the bond should be immediate and it should be effortless. We often hear stories about people who instantly fall in love with their pet, but actually what we know about the research is that meaningful bonds, they often take time to develop and they're built through trust, familiarity, predictability, and shared experiences. Another misconception I see also is that love is enough. And I think love is absolutely incredibly important. But successful pet ownership often requires a lot of time, patience, resources, flexibility, knowledge, and support.
It's a lot. Bruce, I wonder if you ever got to the stage with your relationship with Steady where you went, I wonder if actually he's better off not being with us, like rehoming him.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, those difficult nights, then that is what was on my mind. And I think, you know, you spoke a bit early on about the guilt and shame that can come with thinking things like that, you know, kind of, I guess, shame about, you know, feeling like I wasn't living up to my expectations of myself as a pet owner. But then, yeah, probably, you know, also wrangling with that fear of being judged for not being able to do what, you know, most people, as we've discussed, experience or express as this kind of, you know, effortless, joyful experience of pet ownership. It was kind of a tortuous little, you know, time because, yes, that was a way out from how I was feeling to rehome Steady, but it wasn't really one that I let myself seriously consider. It was more like a dream than a plan.
Yeah. Vanessa, I can imagine that's such a fraught conversation. How do you work through that thought process?
Yeah, look, it's a really, really difficult challenge to navigate. The first thing, I hear Bruce talking about guilt, and I think the first thing that I do think about is that we can feel guilt, but honestly, it's the people who are feeling guilt that are actually the most highly committed owners, and we feel guilt because we really care. And just because we're feeling guilt doesn't necessarily mean that we've actually done something wrong. If it does come to a point where we are thinking about maybe it's best for us to part, before getting to that point, I would encourage people to seek support from their veterinarians, behaviourists or trainers and their family and friends. I think, you know, we think about it taking a village to raise a child. I do think it's also the same for our pets, right? I think it takes a village to raise a pet. So many situations, they can improve, just like Bruce's, with time and support and education and practical help. But there are situations where, despite genuine effort and support, the match just simply isn't right. If the owner's well-being is significantly affected, if the animal's welfare is compromised, or if the household just can't meet the animal's needs, then it is important to consider quality of life for everyone involved.
Before you get to that point, Vanessa, what are your tips on bonding with your animal, getting through this tricky moment?
I think the first important thing to consider is that the relationship takes time. So the first thing is we just got to think about it taking time. So meaningful bonds are built through shared experiences, so rather than, you know, appearing overnight. So that can involve just walking together, it can involve training together, playing together, or establishing some routines and learning your pet's individual personality and communication style. So we often think bonds are built only through these happy moments, but relationships can actually deepen through overcoming challenges together. So working through these behavioural issues or navigating health concerns, adapting to life changes, or simply learning how to live, you know, alongside each other can really build trust and connection over time.
It's so interesting you say that. One text here says, I have a reactive dog. For years, I struggled with it. But once I changed my way of understanding that she wasn't intentionally giving me a hard time, she was having a hard time, our bond changed significantly. She's been my greatest teacher. And another says, from one guardian of a high energy Kelpie cross cattle dog to another, it sounds like you're doing a great job, Bruce. So there you go, Bruce, some love from the text line. Bruce, I wonder if you've got advice now that you would give to people who are going through what you were going through a couple of years ago.
Yeah, a couple of things spring to mind. One is, you know, what one of your callers has texted in saying that what really worked for them was shifting to look at things from their dog's perspective. So, yeah, just getting out of your own head and going, okay, why don't you want to do this, or why do you want to do it this way, and can I work with that? Can we, you know, come up with something that works for both of us? Also, I found some YouTube videos very, very helpful. Just seeing the behavior of professional dog handlers being modeled was really helpful. And then reaching out to that support network. The other thing that I wish I had done is to just foster a dog of the age and kind that you think that you'd like to get. And maybe that'll turn out to be the dog that you get. But at least then you've kind of got this little trial period where you're providing care for an animal who needs it, but you're not fully committed to a lifetime of that.
A lovely list of texts coming through. I inherited, in inverted commas, a 55-kilogram Great Dane Mastiff Cross Ridgeback who couldn't be left at home alone. It was very, very tricky, not to mention expensive. So many feelings, including regret, enormous love, frustration, all the things. Polly says, I've adopted 3 rescue greyhounds, all older. If ever there was a good, gentle companion to have, it is a greyhound. And you save 2 lives, the one you've adopted, which allows another greyhound to be saved from the racing industry. Adopt, don't shop, Polly says. Margaret says, pet regret, never. I took on the responsibility. I was supposed to be the superior being, so I learned their languages and culture. Dogs, cats, birds, fish, guinea pigs, a turtle and a horse. Vanessa, if there's one exercise someone could do with their pet today to strengthen that bond and maybe reduce some of their frustrations, what could they do?
First of all, I'm loving all the stories that are coming through. I think the first thing that you can do, something that you can do right now, is to just sit down with your pet and kind of have a little bit of a mindful moment with them and just sit with them. If you've got a dog, for example, just sit with your dog and just spend some time with them and just being in the present moment. So forgetting about the things that you have to do or should be doing, whether you're a good pet parent or a bad pet parent, just really being with them and getting to know them.
If I sit down, my dogs try to sit on top of me and then I end up covered with dog fur, but it's wonderful. Vanessa, Bruce, thank you so much both for sharing your insights today. Bruce Cherry is a writer, bush regenerator and Steady's best mate. Dr. Vanessa Rolfe is clinical counsellor specialising in human-animal interaction. Coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, tributes are pouring in today for pathologist and melanoma researcher Professor Richard Scolyer, who died yesterday from brain cancer. Next, the co-author of his memoir is going to be in to reflect on his life and legacy.
Hey, it's Zan Rowe, and I'm so excited to tell you the groundbreaking series Race Around the World is back. With a camera, passport, and thousands of kilometres to cover, a new generation will be doing whatever it takes to tell their stories. 6 filmmakers, 10 countries, 1 winner. Join John Safran and I for Race Around the World.
What could possibly go wrong?
Streaming now on ABC iView.
renowned pathologist and melanoma researcher Professor Richard Scolyer has died at the age of 59 after a nearly three-year battle with an aggressive form of brain cancer. And throughout that fight, he continued to push the boundaries of medical science. He became patient zero in a groundbreaking treatment approach to his own tumour, which helped fast-track research that could benefit countless others. He far outlived the devastating survival odds associated with his diagnosis. And in an open letter to all Australians that was released after his death, Professor Scolyer said he hoped to be remembered as a proud, everyday Aussie who gave it a crack, and in doing so, inspired others to pursue their dreams and passions with humility, love, and compassion. Well, Gary Maddox is a senior writer at the Sydney Morning Herald. He helped Richard Scolyer write his biography, Brainstorm, and he's here with me now. Gary, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning.
I'm so sorry for your loss. How are you reflecting on Richard's death today?
It's a sad time, but I'm also trying to remember all the really positive things that came about through not just me knowing Rich, but for so many other people knowing Rich, which is that he was kind of an inspirational person for how he handled his own cancer diagnosis, particularly savage form of brain cancer called glioblastoma. But also just the fact that he was so positive and optimistic about life and enjoying life. So it was trying to remember those things and, also obviously, like so many other people, will just be sad at the news.
Mm. So you're at Petersham Park right now. What's happening there?
Yeah. Rich's family, his brother-in-law, is going to be reading out a statement on behalf of the family. I think it's obviously a very difficult time for them. Rich's wife, Katie, is a doctor. They've got three kids, Emily, Matthew and Lucy. Obviously it would be a time, very devastating time. Rich has really kind of outlived all expectations. When he was diagnosed, 12 to 14 months was regarded as the likely time frame for his survival, and he ended up lasting 3 years. And even after the recurrence of the tumour in February, March last year, he was down to months, as he described it, months, not years. And he ended up, kind of extending that well beyond a year as well. So he has been a very resilient person. I know he also thinks that he was very lucky in the sense that he, was able to get this revolutionary treatment, and the hope is now that what he's gone through and will lead to advances in the treatment of brain cancer through a clinical trial which has opened in the US earlier this year.
How did the two of you meet? How did you come to be writing a book together?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story because I was in 2019 diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma out of the blue, something that was a challenge for me to deal with. I was treated by Melanoma Institute Australia, where Richard and Professor Georgina Long were the two co-medical directors. I didn't meet Rich at the time because he's a pathologist, but my oncologist working with Georgina and using immunotherapy had such success. It was quite amazing. I didn't really know what immunotherapy was, but their advances, their pioneering work in world sense, took survival from 5% to 55%, and I was lucky enough to be in that 55%, and for which I'm very grateful still. And what that meant was that I wrote a piece for Good Weekend, a very raw kind of attempt to be the sort of journalist giving the inside story, not just on what it's like to get a stage 4 cancer diagnosis, but also what immunotherapy is and what a kind of miraculous treatment it has been for so many people. Rich read that piece when he was approached by a publisher. Fortunately, that piece has become useful for a lot of people who get diagnosed with melanoma at that very serious stage. And when he was approached by a publisher, he asked me if I'd be willing to write the book, and I was immediately honoured. I thought it was an important story to tell. I was, did it somewhat out of gratitude, but also when he said that he wanted to do something so that his kids could remember him in a few years' time, I was very moved by that. We both really put our heads down and worked very hard to do it as quickly as possible because of the fear that he might not live very long.
Yeah. What was it like turning such a personal story, sounds like for both of you, into a book?
It was less about me, as it turned out, and I really kind of was dedicated to telling Richard's story as well as I possibly could. He's a very open, honest person. He is the public persona of Rich is very much what he's like privately as well, and the vulnerability that he was able to bring to all his social media and his interviews and was, you know, a key factor in people responding so well to him. I think that was something that he was, to be honest, he had to work at it a little bit, he was so forward focused, somebody who's always about advancing research, somebody who's done 1,000 research papers, co-authored, somebody who's always thinking about the next conference, the next paper, the next breakthrough that they can work on. It was a bit of a challenge getting him to think back to his early life and to talk about it. But once he did, you know, it became quite a moving experience to get a sense of who he was and why he matters and why it's important in cancer research, brain cancer research, melanoma cancer research, you know, why he's somebody, you know, we probably don't give enough attention, enough veneration to people, you know, cancer doctors and cancer researchers as we should, but it's such an important thing. And I kind of found the whole experience very moving, and the very fact that we were able to, you know, the book has become a bestseller and also, you know, has won as, you know, social media book of the year, social impact book of the year is important. I think that was something that he was very grateful for, because it meant that the book was connecting with people.
Oh, well, Gary, thank you so much for speaking with me this morning. Gary Maddox is a senior writer at the Sydney Morning Herald. He helped Richard Scolyer write his biography, Brainstorm. And I might leave you with some of Richard's letter as read by his friend and former neighbour, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
He says this in his final letter: "We all have a responsibility to try to change the future for others and leave the world a better place. The world is a better place because of Richard Scolyer's contribution. That's a contribution that will go on through the work done in his name, but also the work that he has done, which advanced the cause of finding a cure in such a practical way. He continued to work right up until the very end, until it was impossible, but spent, as I spoke with Katie this morning, his final days with family, still in good humour and with the strength, determination and character that defined what is an extraordinary legacy. May he rest in peace."
Thank you so much for your text this morning. My conversation earlier in the show with Dr. Billy Garvey on raising boys. One says, "I'm sitting here in tears, impatient for my son to come home so I can give him a hug." Thanks, Tegan and Dr. Garvey. A heartening, hopeful and inspiring conversation. Jane says, "As a preschool teacher of 30 years, I am seeing a real change in the ways parents engage with their boys to create emotionally intelligent, caring boys. There's lots more dads engaging in parenting and sharing work and family responsibilities. There's still lots of work to do on gender stereotypes." And Nerida says, "Teaching boys to challenge gendered cultural norms is the best thing we can do for boys." So if you want to listen to that full chat with Dr. Billy Garvey, just search for Life Matters on ABC Listen. You can listen back to that chat. You can also listen to the many times he's joined Bev Wang on a Friday to talk about raising children as well. Search Life Matters on ABC Listen and hit follow when you're there so you never miss an installment. Well, that is it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land, but I will be back with you again tomorrow. We'll talk about the fact that actor Tom Holland has revealed his struggles with dyslexia, that he's turned down work because of it. We'll get into what it's like to live with this condition. That's tomorrow on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.